Members, I welcome National Treasurer with us. Representatives, I'm told Mommy and Ishmael will be joining us soon. There's some difficulties with the traveling arrangement, but that's okay. The purpose of our meeting is that the report back on draft segregation program will be formed, and then also during the draft segregation program. We are in your hands. You determine how you want to handle this process in such a way that will allow proper interaction between yourself and the honorable members. We are almost 20 minutes, 10 minutes, no, 15 minutes out of time. So let's try to catch up as quick as possible. It's not your fault, we came much earlier. We have to wait for some other members to be here. And I will make sure that you can sit and have a subject. But over to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, every members, honourable members. There are two pieces of documents. One is the Word document, which is the comprehensive summary of the comments that we've received and the responses. So, and the other one is a slide presentation that sort of pick up on the main issues. Chair, I think we can sort of go in between these two documents if members want a bit more detail. We go to the Word document and some of the high-level stuff will be in the response document. I might just say that the volume of the comments and the volume of the proposals was quite a lot this time, and therefore the very detailed response that we have. But we'll try and make optimal use of the committee's time. Just by way of introduction, these are the officials present today. And Momo, as I said, Chair, unfortunately had to fly in from London this morning, and he's on his way, so he'll join us shortly. Just in terms of process, the bill was published on the 4th of July, and we invited public comments. It closed on the 5th of August, so there was about a month of time for comment. We briefed the committee on the 24th of July, went through quite an extensive briefing on the bill. And the committee had public hearings on the 20th and the 21st of August, and today is our draft response to the committee on the comments that we've received, both comments that were submitted to Treasury directly and SARS, and also comments that was raised during the public hearings by the committee. And the intention is that the bill be tabled later this month, probably early October for the first time. Just to give a sort of a high-level summary of the issues that the commentators raised, the one issue that was raised that we fully take cognizance of, and I think we need to address this, that there are part to many amendments, and it may be spelled out on the volume of these annual amendments. And I think that's an important issue that we will take forward. Some also complained about a limited of time to comment. Other issue is some of the proposals take a retrospective nature, and we need to address that. Another comment about the wide-ranging nature of some of these amendments. Some of them have unintended consequences. And there were some positive comments on quite a few of the amendments, especially those that deal with incentives and e-commerce and so on. So that, those are sort of general thrust of these comments. Members will see in the Word document on page 33 and 34, I'm sitting with the old version, on page 47 and 48, there's a list of about 86 organizations and individuals that commented on. So we've just listed all of them, not in order, so you can have a feel of the number of people. The main issues, Chair, are as captured in the next two slides that we will focus on in this slide presentation. And if members then want to go on to the other issues, we will deal with them in the Word document. So the main issue was the alignment of the tax treatment for individual-based insurance policies. That is the so-called disability insurance and income protection policies. We have proposed an alignment, and that generated quite a bit of comments, and we'll give you our response to those. The other one is on retirement savings. In the retirement savings, there were three issues, and this is a process that's been underway for quite some time. Members are aware of that. And this is sort of the final batch of amendments to get give effect to retirement savings. Then thirdly is the taxation of dividends received for services rendered under normal income tax rules, and that as an anti-avoidance measure. Then the uniform tax treatment of collective investment schemes and hedge funds. Fifthly, the base erosion, profit shifting, and restricting of excessive debt. R&D also, we received quite a bit of comments. The exemption for international shipping, there are some comments, were very positive because it was an incentive. The uniform cross-border withholding regime for the tax treatment of payment for services to try and protect the base. Then on the indirect tax side, there were comments on VAT, e-commerce, and then lastly, Chair, on the mineral royalty proposals and the oil and gas. So those are the 12 main areas that we've highlighted. As I say, there's quite a lot more in the bill itself. The alignment of tax treatment for individuals, Beate, if you can briefly take us through this. And what we've done in the slides is we've, in some cases, just remind you what the proposal is and what the comments are, just to provide some context to this particular. We will not spend a lot of time on the proposals, it's just a reminder for you, but so just briefly go through that.
Good morning to everybody. Good morning. Just in terms of the tax treatment of individual-based insurance policies, basically here was the proposal to align income protection policies, which is basically a policy and insurance policy that you take out in order to protect your income stream in the future, the income that you generate as a person, versus the other type of personal insurance that you would have, for example, if you were to die, the policy would pay out. If you were to become permanently or temporarily disabled. In the latter cases, you don't get a deduction for the premium that you pay for the insurance policies, but similarly, the payout is not taxable. So you don't pay tax at the time where you are most vulnerable. Your beneficiaries don't pay tax. So in the case of the income protection plan, there is a deduction currently available in the law, but then similarly, you pay tax on the payout. Now, there's been some problems with regards to the interpretation thereof. When is it a disability policy? When is it an income protection policy? And it was felt just to clear the air and basically to have policy certainty for everybody involved in that, this industry as well as SARS, as well as everybody using this, the man in the street, to ensure that there's the certainty that everything be treated in the same way. So no deduction is available on the premium, and then also when the payout happens, it's not taxable. So that was the big thing. Feeling from people was that there's not sufficient time to be able to change policies, particularly in an employer context. So what we've done here is we've proposed to move the effective date out by 1 year. And that's mainly to assist employees and employers to come to a different arrangement where it's part of an employment contract, where, for example, you join an employer and this is part of your employment package, so as to ensure that people can actually restructure. So there's sufficient time for that now. Then, should I continue? And then when we come to the retirement, that's something that I think people have been aware of since 2011. A lot of those things have changed and evolved over time, but primarily it is the way that it was in the budget, exactly as we suggested. The only thing that is changed here is a proposal to move the effective date out by 1 year. The main reason for that is, I think, to have the preservation changes that is also been under discussion and part of discussion documents coincide with this, so as to minimise the administrative effect on the industry, as well as to allow for funds to change their rules once off. And it will also give sufficient time for people to be able to do the transition, for employers to meet with employees, with employee groups, etc., just to ensure that it actually becomes part of the system and there's enough time to change rules. We didn't want to spring this on people so that they kind of caught in the middle of the process. Then the last thing I think on my side is the share scheme income recognition. You would see that the proposal is significantly reduced from the initial proposal we had, which was quite wide-ranging. What we've done here is we've taken cognizance of the comments that we've received, in that the feeling was that the policy or the effect of the proposed legislation was having some unintended consequences. So as a result, we've targeted it quite significantly and is now purely an anti-avoidance measure. It's targeted only where a person, for example, receives dividends in respect of services rendered instead of standard fees. So if you, for example, take you through a typical example, if an employer were to set up a trust and instead of the employer paying the employees bonuses or remuneration as part and parcel of just the normal circumstances through a payroll, but uses the dividends in the trust to facilitate these payments. The way that structure currently would work is, unless challenged, there would be a 15% dividend withholding tax for a person that might actually have to pay tax at 40%. So what this does is it says you will not have a withholding dividends withholding tax, but instead it will be taxable in your hands at 40% or whatever your marginal tax rate happens to be. Just because if I render you services, if I perform services for you, what I receive in turn is income for me. It shouldn't be reclassed as dividends. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Beate. That deals with the main issues from page 1 to page 9 on the response document. And Chair, that deals largely with individuals. It might be appropriate that we stand still and take some comments and questions on that at this stage. Just another point from my side is that it's important, Chair, that we view this comments as draft comments. We still have to sort of get the okay from us with our minister. But we hope that we are in a position to give you some indications of the direction that we're going. So I'm not sure if you want to take any questions at this stage, or any other issues that is from page 1 to page 9 on the Word document, or just we focus on the slides.
I was creative.
What we mean by that is if you were to receive dividends in your own name, you would basically have an effective tax rate of 15%, because there would have been 50% withholding tax on the dividends. So for example, if 100 rand in dividends were to be paid out to you, 15 rand were to be held back by the company, so that you in effect only sit with 85 rand at the end of the day. Now, that is all good and well if you're a normal shareholder of a company. But in cases where you're, for example, not a shareholder, but you receive those dividends not by virtue of the fact that you're a shareholder, but by virtue of the fact that you are actually employed by an employer or you've performed services, and these dividends are actually received by you, not because you're a shareholder, but because you've performed services. Under normal circumstances, if you perform services, you would receive income, and that income would be taxable at your marginal tax rate. So you would pay, whatever your marginal tax rate is, anything from 18% up to 40% on that income earned. So if an employer could arrange, or anybody actually could arrange, that their payments is classed as a dividend instead of income, there's actually quite a big benefit for the person receiving it, because they don't pay tax at 18% or 40%. They would actually have a tax at 15%. And that means the policy behind that is, we want you to be taxed according to the thing that you're actually earning, which in this case is income, even though it is paid in the form of dividends. So we're just saying, in the event that it is reclassed as dividends, we're not going to respect that if it was in respect of services rendered, and you're not the owner of the share, or it's not in respect of the share that you will become the owner of at some point in the future.
Thanks, Jack. I hope that clarified the position. Here is what we basically said is an anti-abuse issue that we try to address, where some high income people sometimes have a company set up a separate trust, and the trust take out shares and pay the person bonuses through a dividend rather than normal income. And so this is basically a measure to stop that. We can proceed then to the next bunch of issues, which will take us from page 9 onwards. That will be income tax business. And here, again, it's an issue around dealing with financing structures. There are two issues here. One is the hybrid debt instruments, and the other one is a debt limitation. And Charles and Franz, I think, Johan, you guys need to come in here. If you should, if you want to.
All right, so thanks very much, Cecil. Yes, it will be myself, Franz, Johan, and KG on those issues. Basically, you have four core rules that deals with debt. You have the rules relating to hybrid debt instruments. So that is debt or loans that looks more like shares. So what we're trying to do once again is to reclassify those loans and actually say this is actually not a debt, it is equity. The reason for that reclassification is twofold. Firstly, if it is truly debt, then it is deductible in the hands of the PEO. That reduces your tax. And obviously, it's taxable at whatever rate of the recipient. However, if you have a recipient that is non-taxpaying or that is non-resident, then you end up with mismatch. That is one set of rules that reclassifies debt into equity. Although we don't reclassify the actual instrument, we reclassify the yield, so what you earn in respect of those instruments. And there's another set of rules. This set of rules limits. More of a backstop to transfer pricing. So it looks at interest cover. It says if you are capitalized with interest, with loan, you can only be allowed to deduct up to so much, something roughly about 40% of your earnings or 40% of your adjustable taxable income. But we have a prescribed formula in which we work on it. So that will give you probably an interest cover of about 2.2, 2.3 up to to 2.5, something like that. So we limit that. We didn't follow the debt equity rules in which we tell companies you can only have so much debt and you can have so much equity invested in you. Instead, we went through a rule that says you can only deduct up to so much of interest. You're still exposed to transfer pricing or thin capitalization rules, and this works as a backstop. That is another set of rules. And we had other sets of rules that apply to connected parties. Now, those rules, firstly, they limited deductions on anything, even if it's not interest. There were quite a lot of concerns about those rules, and ultimately we decided to totally remove those from the legislation until such time that we have consulted fully and we have comprehended fully the commercial implications of those rules. So that set of rules we will not go through extensively at this current moment because we have withdrawn those from the legislation. What we're left with now is the debt or the debt equity yield recharacterization rules and the acquisition debt rules. Acquisition debt rules, in the rules that we brought forward from previous years, we've been looking at certain highly leveraged buyouts and highly leveraged acquisitions, and they follow through from that. Essentially, they're replacing what was before a sort of discretion on how much debt or how much interest can be deductible with more objective set of rules. In terms of the actual comments and the responses, and if you're okay with that, Cecil, I would really like to have KG and Frank can always step in on those, and Johan go through some of the comments and our responses to those comments. But broadly, most people, in essence, on the acquisition debt rules, what they don't want is either they don't want the limitation or they want a higher threshold. So they're saying, you know, allow us more or include us into the exemptions. That is the core of the responses that we receive. Some of the responses are more emotional. Some of them are based on facts. And to an extent, that is based on facts, and we actually understand the commercial reasons for those comments. We did take those into account. For instance, things around banks and all, they often provide facts. But some of the comments is just not understanding the anti-avoidance nature of the rules. Some of the rules, once again, they provide a more of a speed bump. Some of them are complete anti-avoidance rules. By speed bump, I mean you can still, you know, like we'll say, don't deduct interest on this instrument. However, you can roll over that deduction for a while, I mean, indefinitely, meaning that actually we're just limiting the extent to which you can erode the debt base, and we're not actually completely denying that deduction, whereas others are putting a full stop and saying you cannot deduct more interest than the prescribed or than the interest determined in terms of the prescribed formula. I'll hand over to KG to just go through some of the comments, and he can, as well, Franz from the south side and Johan from the south side can always intervene and provide more clarity. Thank you.
In terms of where we are, committee members, we are now on slide 19, and I'd just like my colleagues to focus on slide 19 and 20 and 21, 22. So can we briefly talk to slide 19?
Thank you, Cecil, thanks Charles, and thanks Chair and honourable members. I think Charles has summed up most of the comments we received and the responses there too. And I would, Chair, if you may allow, suggest that we take questions, if any, on these issues that Charles has just put.
Okay. Thanks. Haji, you want to add something? You're comfortable? Right? No. So, Chair, the issues that we just discussed runs until slide 22. The next issue is the issue on the simplification of the tax treatment of collective investment schemes in non-profit investments, which is just for the members' convenience. The numbering on the slides 4.2 is similar to the numbering in the response document. So this is our comments on that, and Charles, you may talk to this. Slide. Can you?
Okay. Thanks. So, we initially had a proposal on collective investment scheme that provided for a complete follow through. So that says actually you can ignore the collective investment scheme, and I'm putting it very simplistically. Ignore the collective investment scheme, and income accrues to the participant or the investors in such collective investment scheme, and is taxable at ordinary rate. However, we had some issues, particularly on the hedge funds. The distinction that we had made on the hedge fund didn't go down well, and it was felt that it does not capture the actual business of hedge funds. Our view is still that based on the current framework, the capital revenue framework of the Income Tax Act, hedge funds are pretty much on the revenue space and should always be taxed at revenue. However, as a I don't want to really call it a compromise, but the position that we ultimately took was to retain the current collective investment scheme provision. That is, withdraw that complete flow-through system that we had provided. I mean, that we had proposed. And the current dispensation basically worked on the basis that if a collective investment scheme distributes the profits within 12-month period, then it is treated as flow-through, meaning that those proceeds are taxable at the hands of the participant based on their individual tax profile. And if there is no distribution, therefore that amount accrues to the collective investment scheme and taxable in the CIS vehicle itself. And we also had issues around the debt limitation rules, because some of these property schemes have to, at some point, either convert to regulated real estate investment trust, or we're still waiting for a regulatory framework for the unlisted real estate investment trust. And they felt that because they are capitalized through partly equity and partly debenture, they needed not to be affected by our proposed interest limitation rules. So they wanted to be able to continue to deduct a portion of that capital, which will be interest yield on the debenture portion. And we agreed to that, and in Section 8F and 8FA, which is our debt limitation rules, what we're doing there is we are excluding the property companies that are owned by insurers, pension funds, both long-term and short-term insurers. If they own property company and they capitalize it with the linked unit being a part debenture and a part equity, then we will continue not to limit or recharacterize the debenture portion of the yields on that instrument. That is a transitional measure until such time that the regulatory framework on this is completed. And once it's completed, then a policy will have to be taken on how to regulate unlisted REITs. Either you bring them within the existing framework of real estate investment trust, or you design a new framework. But the concession that we provided is a transitional measure. We're saying in the meantime, you can continue to capitalize your property companies the way you capitalize them, and you won't have recharacterization of the debenture portion. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles, and welcome to Ramon. So we're moving now to slide 24, which is on the Word document, Chair, page 17, dealing with income tax businesses and incentives. We have, just as a background slide, the basic background to the proposal on R&D, and we indicated that we want to simplify this. The comments were very extensive, and they said we actually didn't simplify, we did more than a simplification. And so the one issue that was raised in slide 25 was that some of these proposals were retrospective of nature, and we accept that, and the effective date now will be from 1 April 2014. The other issue was that we need to clarify what we mean by innovation, and we will try and do that in the law. There was a particular provision that we put in to clearly identify that in order to qualify for R&D, you need to do something extra. You can't just do sort of run-of-the-mill R&D to qualify for the extra 50%. The feeling was that the hurdle that we've set was a bit too high. The phrase being world-beating research, and a lot of our research is sort of applied research and re-engineering, and we accept that, and so that particular provision will be dropped. Next, the chair also on the incentives was the proposal on special economic zones, which is an initiative driven by the DPI. These are just the background slides to what we propose in the budget and in the bill. We've received one comment about how we calculate the 90% for the income threshold for companies to qualify for that. And the wording in the original bill gave the impression that it will be restricted to one zone. We now have suggested, based on the comments, that we will broaden that scope and make sure that it will be companies that operate in the approved zones as per the Minister of Finance, and you can aggregate that. There's another proposal on the bottom of page 28 where a few players have suggested instead of a lower 15% rate, we should have an inclusion rate into the company's income, which is at a lower level, say for example 50%. That will prevent the need for entities to set up separate entities in the zone. At this stage, we can't accommodate that particular proposal. It's one thing that we did consider, but it will undo the proposal of the clear lower 50%. But this is something that probably can be looked at in the future, but at this stage I don't think it's something that we can consider. Then on slide 29, there is the oil and gas exploration. The members remember that there is a 10th schedule that provides a specific relief for oil and gas companies and also provides some fiscal stability. What we have proposed there is to restrict the particular incentives to offshore, because that is really where the initiative come from. The history of around this particular proposal was offshore. The comment that we've received is that this would have unintended consequences because the risk profile of onshores are in some cases equally, in some cases actually more risky than offshore. And so we've conceded on that. And so the 10 schedule will be open to both onshore and offshore. The international shipping transport, Charles, you want to talk about it?
Yes, Lutando will capture those and the adjustment to the withholding tax for base erosion purposes.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you, Shay. Announcement by the Minister of Finance was made in 2005 to introduce a tonnage tax. And since 2005, we had consultations and worked in conjunction with the Department of Transport and SAMHSA. Earlier this year, a decision was taken in light of the administration if we introduce a tonnage tax. And decision was taken to introduce a complete exemption for international shipping. because we wanted to have a competitive advantage due to our location. We received, this is the tax incentive, and we received positive comments from the shipping industry, but they wanted more. As it is currently, it is a very generous tax incentive, but they wanted more. They wanted us to exempt even South African shipping industry. But then we have discussion with our industry and Department of Transport, and we continue to have discussion again on the exemption of the South African shipping industry. But amongst the comments that we got was, for example, to not only exempt the international shipping industry, but the activities that are carried by offshore support vessels. And our response to that was that this is more akin to a service than transportation of goods and passengers. This tax incentive is more aimed at exempting the transportation of passengers and goods. Again, another comment that we received was, why don't we widen the exemption to not only to ships that are flagged in South Africa, but also to ships that are flagged internationally. And our view is that we have about 72 double tax agreements that allocate the taxing rights in respect of profit from shipping, from international shipping to the country of residence. And therefore, there's no need to widen this exemption to international shipping transport or to ships that are flagged in, outside South Africa. And there was an issue regarding the exemption of crew members who work on ship. And we have accepted that comment, and we will have a blanket exemption of crew members, whether they're South African or not, who work on ship. There will be exempt from taxation. I'm not sure if Johan would like to add anything on this. Chair, that's all on shipping. Now, going to the withholding tax regime, we earlier in the budget speech, the minister earlier this year announced the introduction of withholding tax on services, and that was going to be aligned with the proposed withholding tax on interest and the revision of the withholding tax on royalties. I'll start with withholding tax on royalties. This is the current withholding tax that we have. But what we did was that we wanted to align all our withholding taxes or our withholding tax regime. The withholding tax on royalties is already in operation, because of the current tax, but the rate will remain at 12%. The 15% rate will only apply with effect from 1 January 2015. The withholding tax on interest as well, it's a new withholding tax, and it should only come into operation with effect from 1 January 2015. With regards to the withholding tax on fees or on services, that was never intended to be a revenue raiser. It was intended to assist our large business center to identify permanent establishments of non-residents. And therefore, the comments that were received were more of complaints about the administration burden that this withholding tax is going to add on taxpayers, who will be required to collect information on permanent establishment, and the fact that it will be difficult for them to identify whether or not a non-resident has a permanent establishment in South Africa. We've had discussions internally and with the taxpayers during our workshop, and the decision that was taken was that we will delay the implementation of this withholding tax, unlike withholding tax on interest and the increase on the withholding tax on royalties. This one will be deferred to 1 January 2016 to allow us to have further consultation with taxpayers. And if refinements are required, then we'll make refinements. And that is all on my side. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Just one or two things. Thanks very much. The first thing is on the crew members. If you work on a vessel, let's say a foreign vessel, and you are an employee, you only get an exemption if you're outside the country for more than 183 days. So now what we had done in the draft bill, we erroneously had substituted that exemption for the requirement that the ship must be flagged in South Africa, and a lot of comments were received on that. It was never intended to substitute that that exemption for a requirement that says you need to have a vessel registered in South Africa. So now we have, for South African employees, we have a blanket exemption. You don't need to be outside the country for any number of days if you are on a South African flagship. If you are on a foreign ship, you need to be outside the country for more than 183 days in order to qualify for the exemption on the as an employee. And on I think that's the one point that I just wanted to emphasize. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Charles and Matando. So, Chair, we're now at slide 34, and in the document is on page 27. So we've now progressed to page 27 of the document, which is slide 34. So it's 34 and I think it's 35. The two slides, it deals with VAT registration. Remember, just again, recall the complaint that we've received is that a lot of companies find it difficult to register for VAT, many small companies, and also new startup, even larger companies have some difficulties. To a large extent, and this is an administrative issue, we try to resolve it through legislation, and I think the proposal that we have made was well intended, but people reckon that it will create other complications. And so we basically withdrew a lot of those initial proposals, but substituted it with two different sets of proposals. One is that we will allow small businesses that have an estimated tax supply of less than 50,000, which they can't register at the moment. We allow them into the system, but provided that they go on a payment-based system on the bottom of page 34, and then obviously they will have to switch over then to the invoice-based system once they breach the 50,000 threshold, provided that they fall in the other provisions that allow for payment basis. This will be done by regulation. And so we make the provision in the law that these businesses may register, but the details of how they can go about registering will be by regulations, and that regulations will be available when the bill, the revised bill is published. A second issue that has arisen is that some businesses that have up to now not been allowed to register because technically they were not carrying out an enterprise will be allowed to register. These are large businesses, and an example is mining and oil and gas exploration, that has a long lead time actually before they become businesses that do make taxable supplies. The concern that they have raised is that they're incurring VAT, which becomes a cost to business, and they can't claim the input VAT for many years. And so, again, through regulations, Chair, there will be a provision to allow these type of businesses to register under two circumstances. So there are two sets of regulations that will be issued relating to VAT registration. And that's 7.1, 7.2 in these two slides. The other big issue around VAT was e-commerce. And although there are a lot of difficulties around this issue, it's internationally recognized that it's an issue that needs to be addressed. And so South Africa, and the comment that we received was also that we should proceed with this. There were a few comments around the definition of what e-commerce is, and that will be cleaned up, so we'll have a revised definition. implies that we start off. So the idea is to start off with a smaller list of what is e-commerce within the VAT net in South Africa, and that will also be issued, a regulation will be issued in this regard. I think that's it. The only other thing around e-commerce is the effective date. There was a passionate plea by a local company that we should implement this as soon as possible, given the Christmas season that has seen a very large, or the Christmas season that traditionally see a very large sales period, about 25 to 30% of the sales in this period. And unfortunately, due to various reasons, that will be very difficult to accommodate. And as a matter of fact, we actually are proposing to move the date 3 months later. So we will only be implementing this effective 1 April 2014 instead of 1 January, and not making it for 1 December this year. That's unfortunate. Then on mineral and royalties, we have made a proposal to deal with the mineral and royalty. One of the comments that we've seen is that we are going to tax beneficiation if we change the schedule. I think that's a misplaced comment, because by the nature of the design, some beneficiation is taxed, but obviously the compromise there was we have lower rates. And so we have reintroduced a range for coal, and coal was the specific commodity that created a few problems. And in the document, and also in the couple of slides that follows, we'll show you the experience that we have. This is just a slide that we've used to show you at what point do we tax it. You can't tax it when the stuff is mined. There needs to be some processing before you can get a value. And this first saleable point is the so-called value that we've talked about. This was the in the initial bill, this was the ranges that we've identified for coal, and we are essentially moving back to this particular proposal to have this range of 19 to 27. I'm not going to go through these slides, so we can come back to the slides and just show you that coal in particular have really significantly underpaid their royalties based on, we think, and a misinterpretation of the law. That's why it was necessary to clean up the law. That really takes us then to the end of the TLEV chair, which is up to page 30 of the Word document. And then the rest of the slide deals with the tax administration. I'll give over to Franz.
Thank you, Saul. Let's go through these quite quickly. Sorry.
Let's hold on. On our members, do you wish to interact with the TLEV? Not possible that the implementation date would still be the 15th.
much that you are moving on and you don't have the clarity and you don't have another presentation on top of some ambiguous within your mind. Can you just take questions? I mean, for what God has actually said, it actually indicates that there is so much that is
Chair, do you want to make the break now or go through the admin stuff first and then take the break?
That's what Honourable Members are saying. Let's take the next presentation and then we'll take a quick break.
Thanks, Chair. And then we'll respond to the question Honourable Ross raised after the break. Okay.
Thanks, Cecil. Thank you, Chair. I'll try and move through this reasonably quickly since people want to drill down into the detail during the break as well. So this slide simply gives you a sense of the kinds of changes that were being made, but let's skip on to one that generated a little bit of heat, which was the whole question of tax returns being completed by people who were receiving exempt dividends, and why did they need to do that? Well, really the answer is because they're exempt, and we're trying to track the flows of exempt dividends from the person who pays it because they think it's exempt to the person who receives it because they are exempt. And that's not as simple as it may sound, because you have intermediaries that may be involved along in the process, and you may also have nominees, and so you it's not one company to another. It may be from a company via an intermediary to the company. Of course, there are also things like STC credits, which people were very keen on. Those have got to be tracked as well. So we're saying this is very important to us to be able to manage the exemption, and therefore we propose that this remain. We would flag that we've had extensive engagements with industry bodies on how to keep this as simple as we can whilst retaining our ability to reconcile the flows of funds. And we're not talking small amounts of money here. You'll also be aware that the collections have dropped quite dramatically from when STC was in existence to the dividend tax. That's expected, but the question is, it should have dropped quite as much as it did, and this will help us to manage that question. Moving on to the Customs and Excise Act, there were some questions around the requirements for a warrant. There should be narrow requirements for the issue of a warrant. All we're doing here is we're flagging that we're using the common standard for warrants, which is that there need to be reasonable grounds. And then we take this to a magistrate or a judge. And the magistrate or judge who issues warrants typically does lots of these and knows what to look for and what should be issued. So there is a judicial oversight mechanism here that ensures that we stick to the standard requirements. As far as criminal investigation is concerned, it's constitutionally permissible, and I mean, anybody who's ever watched the TV program The Knock will know that Customs in the UK does investigations. We don't go quite that far. People who've seen things about the IRS's Criminal Investigation Division will know that the IRS does much the same. Doing criminal investigations is something that a Customs Authority or a Revenue Authority needs to do so that we can lay the charges if necessary. Requesting returns. There was a concern here that SARS could be issuing terms that aren't really required. I hesitate at this point and simply point out that if we issue returns that are not really required, that means we have to process them. So it's not something we're in the business of doing. When we issue a return, it's information that we need. And that is, the ability to issue a return and get information is something that is internationally accepted. So we're suggesting that we miss this ability. Something that was welcomed was some steps we took to assist people who were in a difficult situation because they were out of time on certain reduced assessments. But the point was made that we hadn't gone far enough. We accept that. And what we're proposing here is quite an exceptional rule, which says that even though you've missed the period to get your request for a reduced assessment in, we will reopen the door under certain limited circumstances. Just as taxpayers seek finality, so does the Revenue Service. But we appreciate that sometimes it simply is too unfair to try and enforce a debt that shouldn't be enforced, and so we were trying to create a mechanism that will assist. This then is the flip side of the coin. Sometimes we're in a position where taxpayers drag their feet when we're asking questions to try and run us up against the prescription period, so that either we are out of time to make an assessment or we have to rush the job and it's easier to challenge us. Now, we accept the comments that have been made that the question of whether there were delaying tactics or not can be quite a contentious one. It could be difficult to prove. It will just add complexity. So we stepped back on this one and we looked around the world to see what some other jurisdictions do. And what we noticed was that an alternative approach is possible, where essentially what you do is you pick certain extremely complex matters, say for example the application of the general anti-avoidance rule, and then you add or you extend the prescription period for those particularly complex matters. And that would then also assist where it's not due to the taxpayer dragging their feet, but it's simply due to the fact that it's extremely complex. I'm aware of transfer pricing cases, for example, in the United States that have dragged on for 10 years before they finally got to a resolution, simply because of the complexity of the matters. By the way, for those in the gallery, I'm not suggesting we should extend prescription to 10 years, but I'm simply making the point that these things can be complicated. What we're suggesting here is that we defer this proposal for 2014 and that we then come back with something to address this in a simpler manner. Now, the next provision was one that was welcome, but it was because the idea here is to try and assist taxpayers in getting a lower cost mechanism to deal with certain administrative questions. And whilst it was welcome, some people questioned whether we could actually do this. Now, there are divergent thoughts on this one. I mean, there are the taxpayers who think we have difficulty in doing this. There's another school of thought that says it's quite possible to do this. But there are also some practical issues around the rules of procedure. So we're proposing to withdraw this for the moment, and we'll do some further consultation and research to ensure that this will work when we bring it back. Finally, a couple of other issues. Understatement error. Now, two issues here. People are saying, well, if we made a bona fide mistake, can we have that go back to the 1st of October 2012? We say, yes, that makes sense. And they're also saying, well, can we define what a bona fide inadvertent error is? And our response here is, well, there's a very, very wide range here. And if we try and nail that down in legislation, you'll probably let some people in through the door you don't want to and exclude some people that you would actually welcome. So we're proposing here to leave the term, which gives you a very good sense of what we're looking for, and then to expand on the practical implication of that in guidance that SARS will issue. A final one. The policy decision that was taken when the Tax Administration Act was brought in was that we should move forward using the new provisions. And that was quite clear. Now, what people are saying is, well, actually on reflection, that is unfair. We should in fact have kept the old additional tax system running until whenever it's required to get
simplify the new understatement penalty system going forward. But, and the analogy that was used is, well, it's like putting a speed trap on a road that's never been tracked before. It's, you know, and what we're saying is, now, well, hang on a second, there's always been a penalty for this kind of behavior. All that's changed is how you get to the amount of the penalty. So, having looked at this quite carefully, we don't think there's a problem here. The understatement penalty system is meant to be more predictable. It gives you clear guidelines as to how you fall into the various categories of penalty. And in fact, we think it's a preferable system, and it's one that's aligned with international practice. However, we do accept that there may be some cases, as you would have seen with the bona fide inadvertent error, where perhaps there's an unanticipated consequence, and we will continue to seek to address those issues as people engage with us. But what we would prefer not to see is a situation where people try and play one system off against the other so that they get no penalty whatsoever, even if they have been guilty of or have adopted aggressive or tax evasion type positions. And that's it from my side.
Thank you. After the question, I'll let us in everything on the side. Can we take a 5-minute question? Now, if I say 10 minutes, 50, when I say 5, I'm not counting from 7 to 10 minutes. Okay. All right, let's do that. Those who want to go through some submissions, you can wait now. Thank you.
Thank you. I've used this sort of a template in different our members of the panel for years. Because time is a bit different now, really, but I'll speak on it, you know, as well, not why. Yes.
Okay, honorable members. Let's take our seats. Comments? Questions for clarity?
Honorable Gordon Mok, followed by Honorable Adler Mill and Honorable Tim Harris. Your question, okay, fine. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the comment earlier was made that there was a very high volume this year. I think so too. And it is a little bit of a concern. Maybe it's time for procedural change because of that. And I want to propose something, and I would like to have the comment of SARS and the Treasury. Firstly, I think SARS were very harsh this year. You know, you only had 6 acceptance, partially accepted 6, no's 21, and 1 noted. So it just shows the volume and maybe the attitude. What I want to propose, and maybe you'll comment on that, is that we get the bill and we give the opportunity not only to us, everybody, to see the bill. Of course, you know, that's important that people can see how the act is being drafted. And then we have 1 round of public hearings on the bill after that, and then we process it as a committee. I just would like to have your comments on that. Obviously, it's our decision, but it is a new precedent, but I think it warrants it in this case. And then, just on the accreditation of tax petitions, I think, as I understand it, is everybody that is a tax practitioner, whether he is a partner or a non-partner, must register. Now, there's a cost to that. Is it not possible to say only partners will register? And if you work for that partnership, obviously there's an indemnity you can sign within that partnership. But let's just do it for partners and not everybody working in that institution.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the feedback from the SARS and Treasury. My confusion, which needs some clarity, still goes to slide number 5, bullet point number 3. You know, I'm trying to remember, Chair, that during our time was this thing called the so-called the sweat share, where the company, for some other reason, it allocates a share to its employees. It could be a CEO or whoever, and they name it what a sweat share because no money was given to buy those shares. And at the end or within the 12 months, dividends are given. If that then is the case, I am saying, when that policy was taken by companies, isn't that it was because of some reasons which are key national agenda reasons, like the retention strategy for the scarce resources. They are saying, the company is saying, you are a CEO of whatever big company or whatever company is, and you have got so much skills, but we are unable to afford your salary or the package that you, the remuneration package that you are proposing. And as a result, we are saying as a company, we shall issue these shares for you. If we issue these shares for you, then that will be the part of, like, within the company policy of the benefits added to us, because we can't afford you, but we need you. You belong to within the special resources of this country. That is the case. Here we come as government, the government which says we shall ensure that the special resources are retained. There should be a retention strategy for every company. And that was the part of the retention strategy of those of
some of the companies. And we are saying now, hold on, taxing dividends received for services, because we're trying to implement the anti-avoidance measure towards this, we will make sure that as SARS, if that comes from what I've assumed now, the search share, we shall tax it. Now, where does this leave the national agenda? Where does this leave what we believe in? We need to bridge that. The scarce resources, we need to return it. We need to put policies. Because we need to make sure that whatever amendments of the bill we do, they align with whatever we believe in. That is the first one, Chair. The second one is on slide number 23. Slide number 23, I'm also not clear, Chair. The presenter said, if a collective investment, now it talks about resume for collective investment, where it's about reclassification. Now, if the collective investments are not distributed, right? If they're not distributed, they are then going to be taxed collectively on the REITs. The question is, what is going to happen when then the distribution takes place? Are we still going to tax individuals, or the law as amended will be enabling the distribution thereof after taking tax on the REITs not take place? What is it? It's not clear. I need some clarity here. And then on slide number 24, the reasons for change for the refinement of the R&D regime. It has to streamline in order to facilitate the application process for projects in the pharmaceutical. I think, Honorable Chair, the PDG needs to explain to us. What is this streamlining? Because maybe I'm not privileged with the content of the streamlined that has been gained, information of that streamlined. You know, I didn't see that information. Maybe if I get the information, then I will understand, because I have to understand that the pharmaceutical industry, because of the activities, eligible activities that they do on R&D, do they then benefit from the changes? I want to get that. Now, if it says it was that streamlined, it becomes very general. I need some clarity on that. Thank you, Chair.
So I need to start by making a request that we please get the documents before these meetings. It really, I have not been able to do justice to the 38 pages of responses that we got. I understand the committee only received them this morning, so it makes it really difficult for us to do our oversight job. And I guess this is why I support Honourable Cornock's proposal, that we have further hearings on an updated version of both bills, Chair. I mean, that's really a request to you rather than Treasury. But I mean, my sense is that there's been some concessions made, perhaps more than in most years. But it's actually difficult to tell without time for me to process the changes, or indeed to hear what industry's response is. So I think it would be very, very useful if we could review the updated versions of the bills. Chair, the presentation began with quite a frank admission that there are too many amendments, that there's too much scope in the amendments, that
changing, and that 2 million of them are registering. I wonder if we can ask the DDG for a firm commitment on this. Will Treasury commit that because of this concession, next year there will be fewer amendments, there will be less wide-ranging, and there will be fewer retrospective amendments? I think this has been a running theme over the past few years, but my sense is that this year there was a tipping point, and we've crossed the line of kind of unreasonable complexity, and now I think Treasury's conceded this in the slides, but what we need as a committee is a firm commitment that will start to change from next year. Then, Chair, the DDG missed a discussion we had in the hearings on around the drafting process of these laws, particularly when it comes to engagement with the industry. And there was an allegation made at some point in the hearings that there was a question raised around capacity at Treasury, particularly linked to the fact that one of the presenters said that they believed that there were 13 senior vacancies in the tax areas of Treasury. And then I know the director, Morden, tried to clarify and say that number wasn't accurate. But I wonder if we can get an accurate view on the actual situation when it comes to vacancies in senior positions within tax. I've also heard, I've been unable to confirm it, but I've also heard that since the hearings, Charles McCullough, who was, I believe, director of international tax, but was filling in some of the responsibilities that Keith Engel was handling, has now also left. So, Chair, you will excuse a sense of concern from the side of the House that there might be a problem, and if we're seeing this, perhaps raised levels of confusion and tension between Treasury and industry, perhaps because of these vacancies. So it would be useful to get a clear picture from the DDG. Chair, going through the presentation, I was trying to go through the 38-page document, not the presentation, so I'll just go through by issue, not by slide. But on R&D, I think looking at it now, it looks like we took two steps back and now one step forward. I still have not heard exactly what was wrong with the original tax treatments of R&D before. How much money were we losing? It would be useful for the committee to get a figure. If the provisions were being used in a way that wasn't incentivizing direct R&D, well, how much was that costing us? Because I don't think there are too many factors that have such a big influence on South Africa's future competitiveness than the amount that we spend on R&D. And we saw the figures in the presentations during the hearing. We are well off our own target of 2% of GDP on R&D. So we actually have a problem with the amount we spend on R&D. I wonder, Chair, if it might have been worth losing a bit on the margin in terms of tax just to try and get that percentage spent up. And I agree that there have been some concessions made, we've used one step forward, but I am not convinced that there was a significant problem with the previous regime. And even when we've tried to fix some things, we now need to define innovative. I think we're really just nitpicking when we should be going out of our way to be generous to companies that are prepared to invest in the future and in research for the future. I know one of the presenters said that the tech industry was included in the memo and then not included in the legislation. Can you clarify whether that has been resolved? Then on the next issue, Chair, the special economic zones. There was one request for, a time period to be established for how long the preferential tax would apply. I've just simply forgotten what the original design was. Can you just clarify that 15% tax rate, how long does it apply for? But
broadly, I'm very supportive of the proposals in the SEZ section. I'm also supportive of the proposal under oil and gas, but I mean, essentially, if I read it right, we will now be providing significant tax incentives for companies that frack. My personal views on that is that's a good thing, that this is a potential energy source that South Africa needs. But given that the tax situation will now reward companies that do frack, how will Treasury handle the quite real environmental concerns that South Africans have? Then, Chair, on shipping, I need a little bit more clarity. I understand that the tax break is not extended to government ships or support service ships, so ships like anchor, handlers, and tugs. Why is it not extended to those ships? And if the tax breaks, which are very generous, and I agree with what we're trying to do here, but if we exclude those vessels, and particularly the sailors on those vessels, is there not a risk that we will lose those skills to the merchant sector? Then, Chair, on e-commerce services, I'm not sure if changing the definition from e-commerce services to electronically supplied services actually puts it properly. To me, it actually makes it worse, because electronically supplied services is actually a broader set than e-commerce supplied services. I think that's a step backwards if you're trying to narrow down the definition. And then, again, Chair, I've yet to receive a clear answer on how we're planning to enforce this, particularly when the risk is very real. I think that large e-commerce providers might simply just not bother to sell to South African consumers anymore. And then, Chair, I'll finish now on the tax admin bill. In clause 34, the proposal to allow assessments beyond 3 years, can I confirm that that's now off the table and that we now leave the 3-year limit in place? And secondly, I can't find the provision around warrantless search and seizure. I think I might have missed, but you discussed how a judge can get a warrant or how a warrant can be obtained, rather. But if I remember from the original presentation, there were prescribed conditions for warrantless search and seizure. And I remember asking the question, or rather floating the concern that those were perhaps too generous and too broad. And I can't find it in the document. Thanks very much.
Mama will start and then we will try and follow.
Let me just start with a broad proposal and the process, because I have a lot of sympathy for problems that Honorable Kurnoff and others have raised about the process. And I think trying to understand text amendments at the best of times is always going to be very complex and, I would say, unsatisfying. I think, however, there are two and many players on this. We can't give any commitment, because unless some of the companies represented here, whose job it is to find tax loopholes, stop operating aggressively, there is no way that government would give that commitment. If you find something is tax aggressive, we will make an announcement. It will be retrospective, and I want to come to what the definition of retrospective, what we mean by that, but certainly from the date of announcement. We have done that on exceptional occasions. You can have a look at the UK, you can have a look at other jurisdictions. That, unfortunately, is the game around taxation, and nobody can give any guarantees. So until we have a guarantee from major corporates and tax advisors that they aren't going to play that game, and I don't know how we do that, I don't think that you can ever get a commitment from any government on not to do certain strong measures, certainly. And certainly worldwide this is an issue. But having said that, I mean, clearly we have recognized that the process is too complex, that the changes, there are too many changes annually. It's hard to keep up even for the best tax experts. And for that reason, Chair, we referred this matter to the Committee under Judge Davis to look at our process and see how we can actually, is it possible to simplify the process? Is it possible to break this vicious cycle that we find ourselves in? And indeed, I mean, those practices are there for all to see, I think. And unless society begins to hold corporates to their ethical standards, and shareholders don't want aggressive tax practices because they don't know that if they found out, it would hit the company more. And of course, it's always future shareholders who then pay for the sins of the shareholders at the time of those transgressions. So all of those, I think, are important issues to certainly discuss and see how best we can proceed. I think just in terms of our own bill, and let me say that what we tried to do, and that's why we have the response document, and yes, I'm sure it would be easier to if these documents are available before, but the schedule this year has been tight even from a parliamentary side. But to the extent that we try and make it easier, what we do remember is we print the tax laws amendment bill, we put it out there, and then we have the hearings typically sometime after that. So lots of players can respond anyway. And then, we have our own hearings, you have your hearings, because given the nature of tax proposals, it's only once people see the draft legislation can they really see how the announcements the minister has made is actually going to take effect, how it affects them concretely. Otherwise, it's not really possible to see the full weight of the announcements. And obviously, when we publish, nobody has seen sight of these provisions. So it's quite possible that we could have got it wrong, could have gone too far. So there's a lot of revisions. And I think the process of the hearings, the workshops that we have, are quite essential. At some point, we have to stop the process. I don't think we are closed, and it's up to Parliament to have a further hearing. But what we do today is it's a draft response document that's still subject to some discussion. And obviously, I mean, we will only firm up the draft response after this hearing. And we still go through the clause by clause. And if issues have arisen, we try and bring it to the attention of the committee just to ensure that you are aware, I think, of all the issues. I think we've said in this bill that we haven't raised new issues. We also get submissions where people want us to change clauses that we haven't intended to amend. Some may be consequential, but some are completely new. And at some point we have to resist continually, obviously, lobbying to have things change. So it is a two-way street, and certainly the very people who ask can say, the process is too complex, are themselves big players in this game, and it's often convenient for them to say that, because if they are going to play tough, we have to play as tough. Okay, we're not good. We cannot yield if the others are also not working in the long term. Well, looking at the broader issues and not trying to support short-term advantages. But however, as I said, having said that, also I think when you look at issues like, so therefore, we want Judge Davis to look at whether we can have thinner bills every year. That's an issue that we would welcome actually examining, and I can promise you that if we succeed in that, it will certainly make our lives easier. we try not to let it be too wide-ranging, but that's a matter of policy of the government. If it wants to deal with broader issues, obviously, then these bills have to give effect to those. And certainly when it comes to retrospective, what do we mean? Is retrospective to, when a minister makes an announcement, it still takes about 7-8 months before, it could take about 10 months or even a year before the act takes effect. So is retrospective before the announcement? Is it between the time of the announcement to when the law is passed? I don't hear anybody complaining that when we bring the rates a bit lower, when we deal with fiscal drag, that it's retrospective and it should only take effect next year. So obviously people only complain when the measures affect somebody sort of negatively. The fact that it affects the state negatively, that we therefore get less income because it's retrospective, nobody complains. So I think we need to look at the retrospective clause. I think it should be an exceptional measure, and perhaps it has been utilized too often, this bill. Can I also say that I think we should also focus on outputs, Honorable Harris. You know, if you want us to get the public service bill up, we can hire hundreds more people. The point is in the output, yes. Keith Engel has left, and that is a problem. Some of the same companies that complain about capacity are raiding our staff, and indeed I would like to see some standards for how they utilize such staff, that they not use immediately after they leave, so that they don't have any extra sort of advantage. But you can see from the team, we do have depth, and whilst it is difficult, I think issues of why people leave are related to salaries, are related to prospects compared to what, I mean, most of the team here could probably get higher salaries if they crossed over. The fact that they're here, they are dedicated to this job, and certainly I think there's depth. And I think unless you find a flaw in the output, I really think that we should focus on the outputs. If the output's a problem, then let's focus and see what's the problem. Is it in the input? I don't want to comment on specific people, but yes, we always have people leaving and coming. But again, that's an issue for another time. But again, if you have an understanding with the industry that they won't raid our staff, and we have the flexibility to pay higher salaries, the game could change. But we are in the public service, and those are some of the challenges that we have to face as managers. Having said that, I'm quite proud of the team. I think that we have met the challenges, and all those coming to accuse us of lack of capacity, I would take them on, and let's look at their own behavior. And I think that those are not just innocent remarks. Perhaps we may be becoming tough on them. Perhaps they're not getting their way, because I do want to put in practice in our team proper standards, because we have workshops that we do not get unduly influenced by anybody. So whilst we make some concessions, we don't always concede on everything. And yes, that doesn't make us popular. We are just concerned that we are equally unpopular amongst everybody, so that we know that. Because if we're popular with any particular group, it means we've been too generous to them. So, So I think just then to get to the specific issues, I'll answer some of them, and I'm going to invite the team to answer the others. I think with regard to the retirement proposal on the Ross and when they take effect, look, that has been a difficult one. Bear in mind that this bill doesn't deal with the preservation issue. When we presented the bill the first time, we did say that these were just the first set of changes. I would have loved to have put the preservation clause in, but that wasn't really possible for various reasons. And if you look at our proposals, there are two dates, a T day and a P day. And as we've talked to certain players, they've said, look, employers, etc., and payroll admin people that there are going to be some difficulties if you have different dates, because they may have to renegotiate with their staff. And I think, however, I think we'll re-look at the date of effect. We'll see if we can't bring it to 2015. That's for the contributions. But as I said, there are some really technical issues which come in the way. But we'll look at it, and when we go clause by clause, we'll see if we cannot make that early in spite of the difficulties. I think just with regard to before the rest of the team comes in on the oil and gas incentive, we obviously are not saying, I personally think we should reflect because our carbon footprint will be lower, and I'm happy, in spite of our differences on the carbon tax, that the environmental issues are important, and I would still like to convince you that's why you need a carbon tax. We're not going to go the way of Australia, I hope, and the reason for abandoning are quite different, because the leader, well, the new prime minister doesn't believe climate change is a problem. And I've seen comments even from industry on that. The very same people saying there hasn't been a proper process. We're still in consultation mode. So come on, what are you saying? And similarly on the issue of fracking, I think it's an important one. There are different processes, as you know, to decide who fracks and when we start fracking, if we do frack, okay? Largely led by the Department of Mineral Resources, okay? But to the extent that there are approvals, then this is just a tax process to obviously say that they would enjoy this benefit given the high cost. But Cecil can perhaps say more on that. I just wanted to end with the last point, that in a lot of these, and the nature of tax policy, is that there are lots of anti-avoidance measures. So, the question you raised, that people give shares, those are hot issues because they may all, if you don't watch it, there may be methods of avoiding to pay their fair income tax. And yes, it's a tool that people can use for retention, but if you look at the big debates around banking, for example, you look at the incentive structures, those are important to tackle. But let me sort of ask, I've dealt with the retirement issues. Cecil, do you just want to deal with the oil and gas issue first, since I've touched on it, and then we can go through the other issues.
Thanks for those inputs. The oil and gas, yeah, I think you've answered it. Way the original wording was interpreted that it includes both onshore and offshore, we then proposed to exclude onshore for reasons that we've explained to the committee. I think based on the inputs that we've received, we say that let's include onshore. But we also had a discussion with the industry to look at the whole tax regime for oil and gas going forward and maybe to have a different regime that is more flexible, similar to the royalty regime. And from one of the oil companies, they had sort of said that is a positive issue. And that is something that we will research and probably through the tax committee look at that. On the environmental consequences of fracking, I think the licensing regime that will be issued will take care of that. I think there will be stringent licensing regimes by the Department of Mineral Resources, Department of Environmental Affairs, and the Department of Water Affairs. So we're comfortable that should fracking that environmental aspect has been dealt with. And as Momo said, if you proceed, the positive spin-off there is that our carbon footprint will be reduced and the tax consequences of the carbon tax will also be reduced. So that's the oil and gas issue. Can I go back to the initial questions by, let's take it by member, Mr. Honorable Kurnov. I think your questions has been dealt with. The only one is tax practitioners. France will deal with it. You want to deal with it, France?
There were two sets of issues here that I thought I'd just quickly touch on. The one was the balance between acceptance and non-acceptance. I just point out that you need to look at what's underneath those words to sort of see where they're taking you. So, for example, if you were to look at the very first not accepted, CF not accepted because the comment's in conflict with the Supreme Court of Appeal judgment. So it's very difficult to accept something under those circumstances. Equally, if you, and that's on page 33 for those that are interested. If you have a look at page 42 in another comment, again at the foot of the page, you'll see that the not accepted there at the top of the page in 43, if we were to accept this comment, we in fact create a harsher penalty than if we were to not accept it. So in fact, that not accepted is taxpayer favourable. So I think you do need to look at the underlying points before you come to a conclusion on the pure accepted to not accepted. As far as the tax practitioners are concerned, we already have a mechanism whereby somebody who is under the direct supervision of a registered tax practitioner need not register. Right. The comment from industry has, however, been that they find that a bit narrow, because direct supervision essentially would mean that if I'm the clerk doing the work, it is my manager who needs to be the registered tax practitioner. And the question has been, well, can't we go a level even further up? Now, of course, the problem with that is as you go further up, so the accountability becomes more diffuse. And so the question was, well, how can we accommodate that desire whilst retaining accountability? And that is why the proposal we put on the table is that a registered tax practitioner accept accountability for the person who is not registering. Okay, so that the line of accountability is clear. Now, you could say, well, just follow the reporting line. That should not be an issue. However, the reality in most practices is that one person may work for many people. I mean, I don't just work to person A, I may work to person B as well. There may be matrix management, in which case I have multiple managers depending on what I'm doing. And once you start doing that, the potential for finger pointing if something goes wrong becomes quite significant. You know, no, it wasn't me, it was him, it was her. So we're saying, what we're looking for is somebody to say, I take accountability for these people, and I will ensure that they are properly supervised. If something goes wrong, I am the person that the complaint will be lodged about. And we think that's a reasonable compromise to assist the industry in this regard. And I think that you can move on now.
Thanks for that. Honourable Glavini, your questions relate to the shared evidence. Let me try and take a stab, and if I not succeed, then we ask you to come to try and explain this again. The intention is not to discourage retention strategies and policies. As a matter of fact, the contrary is the case. The point that we're trying to make here is that one of the key principles in tax is horizontal equity. So that people in the same position should be treated the same. Shouldn't treat one person different from another person. If I get a salary of 1,000 rand per month, and you happen to get a salary consisting of 500 rand normal salary and 500 rand dividends, you should not be treated differently if you do the same job. That's basically what we said. So by reclassify the type of income that you get should not give you a tax benefit. So all we're saying is that if you're getting an income stream that is classified as a dividend income and it's really payment for services that you've rendered, you should be taxed. I think you would agree with that because you don't want to create an unlevel playing field. But that doesn't yet mean companies can't issue shares for their executives or whatever the case may be. That has nothing to do with this. It's just a common horizontal equity principle. And to the extent that the tax system currently do allow people through various mechanisms to undermine the horizontal equity of the system, we need to correct it. Okay, I hope that put it very plainly. You want to add to it?
Thank you, Cecil. Just to put your mind at ease, the type of transactions that you were talking about where a person has received a share, as in, and is basically a shareholder. So if you're my employee and I were to give you a share and you would receive dividends in respect of that share, this will not apply to that particular set of circumstances. So that will be normal dividends, there will be normal withholding tax. Also, let me go one step further, that if you've got a normal employee share scheme aimed at retaining your employees, and you say, if my employees continue to work for me for a period of 3 years, if they're still employees after 3 years, and assuming they still meet the requirements, etc., they then, so their performance is still at a certain level, then they would get the shares. It will also not apply to those. So those type of share schemes will not be affected by this. So your normal BEE share scheme, your bona fide retention employee share schemes will not be affected. What will be affected is if the person receiving the dividends will never become the owner of the share. So the only thing that they're receiving is the dividend. And there's not a plan that this person will ever become the owner thereof, isn't the owner thereof, firstly, and secondly, will not become the owner thereof. So it's not restricted in terms of that person. In those cases, we say, wait a minute, this is something else. So the circumstances you were talking about, no problem. That can still continue and this will not affect it.
Thanks, Beatrice. I'll ask Charles just to talk on
Sorry, check. That chair, it becomes very critical. That is not directly to the DDG. What has been said now, when we are finished with this discussion, it actually gets included. Because if it's not included, we are on the draft, it will create a real confusion. Because you are talking about what I understand now, but if you're looking at the terminology servers, it makes a very thin line to actually say what are we talking about. So which means if you are being taken to court, we might lose the case. Thank you.
On the CIS that you raised, I'll ask Charles if he can briefly comment on that.
But also, before that, let's get your take on the...
No, I think the point is taken. I think the Honourable Member has accepted the explanation. We will just have to make sure that it's embedded in the law and in the explanatory memo.
Thanks, Cecil. And the question is a question asked by Honourable Matamini on the CIS. Effectively, if the CIS pays the tax, the participant do not pay the tax. So you will exempt that distribution. So similarly, if there's no tax in the CIS vehicle, the investor himself will be liable for tax. That's one aspect in that slide 23. There's another point which we emphasized there, and that was exempting the CISs from the debt equity rules. So certain, as a transitional measure, certain property companies, until such time that the regulatory framework has been finalized, will be excluded from the debt equity rules that we prescribe in Section 8F and 8FA. But on the CIS side, we find that we can't impose a double layer of taxation on the same income stream. Thank you.
Okay, your last question was on R&D, and I'll try and deal with both the R&D questions then at the same time. I think the R&D incentive has now been in place for about 4 or 5 years. Last year we changed it to a system where you have a committee that needs to approve it. And I think there's general agreement that would be a better process for two reasons. One, it will provide us with upfront information about what R&D proposals are on the table so we get good data. And secondly, once the committee and the Minister of Trade and Science and Technology is approved, there's certainty for the clients. In the old legislation, or the current legislation, before the 2012 amendment, there was a lot of uncertainty in terms of whether they would qualify and SARS will come in disapprove of all these things. So let's just say that. The committee is obviously take a little bit of time to find its feet, and I think now the committee is sort of up and running. On the pharmaceutical specifically, the problem that the committee is experiencing is that there was not a clear understanding of what aspects of pharmaceutical will qualify, especially when it comes to clinical trials. And so we had a lot of debate about whether we include it in the law, or we can amend it, and so there was then a provision in the law that you'll have regulations specifically referring to the pharmaceutical industry. That intention is still there, and the Department of Science and Technology is busy with the guidelines that will, and what my understanding, and I'm not a scientist here, that with clinical trials, it basically got three phases, and
expectation was that only phase 1 and 2 would qualify, not phase 3, for various reasons. I think in the last discussion with the industry, we had quite a big meeting with them, is that we should allow all three phases, and that will be clarified. So that was the basic problem with pharmaceuticals. It was just a clinical trials issue and whether it should qualify. So I hope that will clarify it. And I think we will make the guideline document that the Department of Science and Technology prepared available to the committee. That should be ready within the next month. Hayley? So that document is there. Sorry, you have a question on that?
In terms of some analysis that I've done, in terms of the comments accepted and the comments noted and categorized as misplaced, etc. I just went through the document and I have to give you credit. The comments accepted is 51. And
Sir Chair, the member is out of order because they are not listening. What system is doing now is responding to a particular question and the member is taking the presenter back to another question. Can you just finish what he's explaining, Chair, and then go back to what he's saying?
All right, there's someone, Honorable Tibazana. Honorable Ross, could you please continue?
Thank you, Chair. Stop chairing the meeting.
Yes, Chair.
We note that partially accepted as 18 and commencement place is 13, and it gives us a broad indication as to the consultative process of industry that Mr. Morden has just mentioned. And just putting it into the context of your last remark, we can clearly see there's good consultation with the industry in this regard. And I just had one concern before moving on. There was also a presentation, if my memory serves me right, and perhaps maybe Ms. Sander is quite correct in saying I'm a bit out of line, but I'm concerned with regard to the presentation on e-books, where there was such a huge presentation in terms of the time frames. Are we still online trying to adhere to those time frames, or has the patient?
Now, Honorable Ross, I think, Honorable Bezana was correct, but it was for me to allow you to finish and make a determination. So let's not forget, members, we have a provision for follow-up questions, So, Cecil and Momo and your team, could you please continue responding to the first set of questions that have been posed?
Okay. Cecil, do you want to continue?
Yeah, I was busy with R&D and I'll finish off with that. So we've dealt with R&D. Then Mr. Harris also raised an R&D question. I think you're right in saying that we have made proposals this year and we've stepped a little bit back. I think it's for the better. We had a good consultation process, a good meeting with the industry, and thanks to the issue of pharmaceutical was an issue. The other problem that we had was with business processing, which we exclude from the R&D incentive. And that was a very tricky issue, how to word that to make sure that is excluded. The other issue on R&D is that we do publish a tax expenditure statement annually. And so I will refer you to the budget review NHSC. There we indicate the revenue. And Hayley just indicated me since 2007 to 2011, the total revenue for GOD was in the order of 2 billion rand. Just give you a rough indication. I just want to show you one slide which the Department of Trade and Science and Technology is busy with, is that we have, despite the incentive, not been very successful in upping R&D expenditure. So, if you look at since 2001, R&D expenditures increased, and obviously there are many other factors that impact on R&D other than the incentives. And so we've reached a high of 0.95% just before the crisis, and obviously after the crisis one expected companies might pull back a little bit for various reasons, and unfortunately it has come down. So there's many other factors that influence the R&D spend. Our challenge to the industry was that despite the incentive, we are actually incentivizing current expenditure. We didn't incentivize additional expenditure. And so the challenge is to make sure that we not only waste our money on R&D that would have happened in any case, but to look at that particular and see that slide result. And I think that is a common understanding and achievement
that you'd like to, or something that you'd like to achieve, and the Department of Science and Technology would like to move it to 2%, but you can see it's going to be quite a challenge to achieve that. But we hope that the R&D center could play a role in that respect.
Does someone that hate that? I'm not sure what the question is. It's a very useful number, the tax loss number. So it's 2 billion for 5 years.
Approximately 4 years.
For 4 years. What I was actually asking, I mean, that's important to see how much we're giving away in tax returns. But in your original presentation, you said that incentives can be claimed in respect of activities that were never intended to fall within the ambit of the regime. What I was asking is, how much of that 2 billion do you think is ascribed to activities that were never intended to fall within the ambit of the regime?
I understand the question. I think it's very difficult to put a number to it. Are they the ones to just give an example?
Just an example. So currently we're sitting with claims, for example, that are due at R&D that we wouldn't necessarily want. So firms claiming large expenditures for improving their internal business processes, which was never intended. So if you improve your HR payroll system from improving your computer system, they're claiming R&D for that. And one application on that was the equivalent of R&D tax expenditure in 1 year. So it was in the order of 700 million rand. So things like that. So we recognize the point that you raised, that we want to stimulate R&D in the country. Obviously, it's beneficial for our country as a whole for economic growth and skills, but we don't want claims like that and consultants going around finding expenditure in firms and trying to find as much expenditure as they can to push through the R&D system. And also, using distinction that law, there's been a misinterpretation, so they see that if they meet the definition in the third section of the legislation, they automatically get the 150%, whereas you actually need a little bit more if you want to get approval by the minister. So there's been a bit of misinterpretation as well, but that gives you an idea of the numbers and the problems that we're sitting with.
Thanks, Hayley. There's two more issues that I'd like to address, and then I'll give over to Momo. The issue of the SEZ, I think the time period is 20. I'm not sure if I've got a law in front of me. 2020? 2024. Okay. So we have this is what we do with most of our incentives, is to give a sunset clause in the incentive. And in many cases, we extend that sunset clause. We've done that a couple of cases, for example, with the UEZ. And the reason for a sunset clause is twofold. One is, you probably want this incentive to end at some time, but also it allows us to review the incentive. And it's a forced review to say, give us the information that we assess it, is it working? So in this particular case, that's the time period that we have. Okay. And then lastly, from my side, there's one on shipping, which I will ask Rotunda to reply to. On e-commerce, there are two questions. One is the appeal by one company that we must implement it earlier, and the other one is enforcement. I'll leave SARS to try and deal with the enforcement issue, but I'll sort of give it a stab. On the implementation date, there was a huge appeal to implement it as of 1st of November or 1st of December this year. It's practically just not possible. We would love to do it, and I was sympathetic to that call, but the legislation is not in place by then, because you first have to get legislation in place, and secondly, you have systems in place for SARS. So unfortunately, we're sitting here with practical reality that this is not doable. On enforcement, yes, we will experience some challenges, but we've had a look at what other countries are doing, and I don't think it's unique, and I'm not sure you want to take a step in that front.
Essentially, when you're dealing with large e-commerce suppliers, they see a reputational issue here, and so they will voluntarily register. That's the experience that has been seen in other countries that have implemented similar provisions.
So that, I think, deals with the e-commerce. On the definition of e-commerce, I think we have agreement with the industry broadly that this definition is more appropriate. We will have, as I said, regulation that specify the type of supplies that will qualify.
Yes, sir. So thank you, Mama. This earth incentive was never intended to exempt the entire shipping industry from taxation. It was targeted only at making South Africa an attractive location for international shipping companies to register or to be flagged. I mentioned the proposal from the industry to exempt services rendered to offshore oil industry and ship rigs and oil rigs. But it's not only that. I mean, we got requests to exempt shipbuilding, ship brokering, trading, shipping derivatives, ship financing, all those things. So if you do that, you're actually exempting the entire shipping industry. And if you have a tax incentive of this nature, I mean, this is very generous. You need to be able to monitor who uses it and whether or not there is abuse. But if you exempt the entire shipping industry, then you might as well, you're creating a bad system, because next day we might have mining industry coming to us and say, if you can exempt the shipping industry, you might as well exempt us. The financial sector might actually do that as well. So you need to be able to monitor the use of incentive. And yeah, but if you give a wide range, wide-ranging tax exemption, then it might create a whole lot of other problems. But as indicated earlier, we continue to consult with the industry on things that are doable and things that are not doable. We haven't closed the door for consultation. Well, this is a new tax incentive, and we'll continue to develop it as time goes on. Thank you.
But just on the shipping, can I just say...
Okay.
Hold on, one more question.
Yeah, I just, perhaps, the industry is going to deal with this, but my question is in particular, how do you deal with the unintended consequences the industry is anticipating that you're going to get skills leaving the non-merchant sector to go to the merchant sector? Because those tax breaks also apply to the actual sales, and we have ships like the SAO Gullis, which is 1.3 billion rand, which is stopped by sailors who are totally ineligible for these regenerative tax breaks. So that's a potentially an unintended consequence that I was trying to understand if you made contingencies for.
All right.
Yeah.
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 That's something that we look at. I don't think that the problem with taking this thing too far is that you then want to have all sorts of sectors claiming that particular unlevel playing field. But I think you raise the point, Mr. Harris, that we'll have to look at and make sure that unintended consequences address.
Bad man, I mean, this incentive was there because there was only one ship registered in South Africa. So it's trying to just create an environment where you can get more ships to register, but you know, as you have any incentive, you start having many other implications. That's why ideally you should have no tax incentives and have a clean system, but it gets us into other discussions. But yeah, I think we I think France had just an added issue.
On the same issue.
Thank you, Chair. Two issues were directed to me. The first is the extension of prescription from the 3 or 5 years. Is that correct? That is off the table. We'll be back next year with a simpler proposal that will deal with complex matters. Then the question on warrantless search and seizure. The proposal that we put on the table draws greatly from the reading in that Judge Owens provided in his review of customs and excise search and seizure powers. So we believe that it's fully aligned with what the Constitution requires of us. One of the drafters was involved in this, was in fact involved in the drafting of the Constitution. So we're pretty comfortable that this is fully aligned with what is required and what the courts should uphold.
I think we're done.
Maybe before.
chair before you close the chair.
No, I'm not closing. Oh. I'm not closing just the dictation. Maybe before we come to that simple conclusion, let me also, we will open up for follow-up questions, starting with the question of the element that I'm across earlier on. I'm not sure, because the other element of this e-commerce provision, which is applicable, of course, to any, transition provision, is how the cost of import going to weigh in. Because I'm not getting clear. I know I raised the same question in your initial meeting, but it was also raised today. And still I'm not getting clear, because I want to strike a balance between the effects. It's not very useful exercise if really the costs are going to obviously rise up. I mean, all these efforts, because I've been spending time, and there's a lot of time that's been spent in the office, and we really need to have a lot of time. Can we strike a balance? We're not foreseeing a stage whereby we are just living for the sake of compliance and formality, more than any other thing. And then lastly, from my side, size becomes an issue when we deal with issues of provision, more especially around your R&D provisions. Now, I'm not sure, because I was trying to check if maybe our small and medium-sized companies, to what extent are they advantaged by these provisions? Because at the end of the day, at the end of the day, one's intention is to promote, obviously, innovation at that level, you know? So I'm not sure, the effect of this, because we might be having big thresholds that obviously doesn't even cover, that small size or medium size, entities. I'm not sure. With our current, proposed, provision, to what extent are we ensuring that they are not disadvantaged because of their size? I think those are the two issues that I wanted to raise. And then I think we got the first one from the elderly. I think that was appropriately captured, not unless you want to repeat it. Responded to? Thank you very much. Can we get follow-up questions?
No, it's not a question, Chair. It's a request to the DDG and the team that how possible it is. I don't know where to include it, whether to the regulation or whether to the definition. Eligible activity under RD. You know, so that at the end of the day, if you apply for this R&D incentives, you are aware of the criteria, because eligibility or the eligible activity has been well explained. This is just a request.
So, in the absence of any follow-up question, we
no,
I have to get to Momo's
No, I think the comment on the R&D is well taken, and you hope that the revised legislation will deal with all of those indicators. And I think the guidelines that we will be drafting with the Department of Science and Technology and SARS's interpretation notes that will follow would probably deal with that. And we will certainly make a copy available to this committee on that. On your question, Chair, on the size, this is really not an issue when it comes to a business with taxable income. Remember, this is a tax incentive, and to the extent that you're in assessed loss, you carry it forward. Within a particular year, obviously, when you're in assessed loss, the extra deduction is not available. If you're in assessed loss for a long time, then obviously the incentive is quite limited on no real value to you. But there, other initiatives by the Department of Science and Technology in terms of grants and co-funding of research and development. The incentive in that particular area has got limited scope, but it's not restricted to size. On e-commerce, I think we basically have to say to you, this is not unique to South Africa. Lots of other countries are dealing with e-commerce. E-commerce has been identified as a base erosion project that France can probably talk a little bit more. It's based in Paris at the moment. So, France.
E-commerce is clearly a growing issue. I mean, in the domestic
context, you maybe have to look at some of our bookstores to see how many have closed because people are shifting into electronic media. And the question here then is, we have local players in the electronic space and we have international players. And why should one group have an advantage over others? So all we're trying to do is level that playing field to make sure that people are competing on the merits, not on the fact that there's a 14% tax incentive to buy your product from an offshore supplier. And that's really all we're trying to achieve. The market here is large. You had submissions from one of the players here as to the amount of strain they are under precisely because of this unlevel situation they're confronted with. And so I think it's very significant. It's going to grow. The internet speeds in South Africa are still relatively modest by international standards, but as they get faster, you're going to start looking at things like video streaming. So you pay that on your DSTV subscription, but if you get one of the international suppliers providing you with movies and programs, should you be paying that on that too? I think the answer is yes. So you need to bear all of that in mind. It's not something that's going to get smaller, it's something that's going to get bigger as time goes on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, you also need probably more globally coordinated or harmonized approaches, because you see with Amazon.com, there's been a tax measure to apply to them, which is done through federal law, but there are states also that want to impose, and they are opposing that measure. So, no, I was just going to say that this is, like Francis said, it's a growing area. You do want to equal the playing field in different ways, and I'm sure we'll come back to these measures because there'll still be gaps and so on. So, I think just to end off then, since you didn't want a simple ending, I was going to say that... No, I was just going to say that I think the issues raised on the tax process is something we continually look at, and so we are definitely open to how can we improve it, how can we make it more transparent, how can we ensure it's fairer. I should add that when we have workshops, it's not just with industry, we've had a fair number of workshops with labor, but at the end of the day, it's who comments on the bill, and that's critical, because if people don't comment on the bill in the first place, it's very hard to figure out who you include in such workshops. But we do try and reach all players, and I think it's quite important we don't just get to industry, because there are other players, and the public interest also needs to be looked at. So these are difficult issues, and as I said with Judge Davis, because this was identified, and we did raise it in our first presentation, and that's what the minister had included in the terms of reference. So aside from what Parliament will decide on how to deal with money bills, and there's all those sets of issues, but the process through the Tax Review Committee, I think, does also offer an opportunity. Thanks.
All right, thank you very much, members. That brings us to the end of our business, but then before that, there was an issue raised. We understand that if your team was under pressure, I mean, this important responses. But at the same time, I think going forward, we just have to go an extra mile to ensure that as a committee, we get, I mean, this feedback at least a day. Normally, 2 days, but at least a day. Because if we don't do that, I mean, that's also, I mean, defeat the purpose of the data. I mean, we are here to ensure that proper oversight is conducted over the function, but also to make sure that the submissions that we get from other role players is given due consideration as we finalize this important piece of work. So I will once more urge you to accelerate the data, no longer than a time frame, but please make sure that we don't get. And I think in my marathon, we've got 15 action. It's like something that is perennial. And I know it's not enough to be but please make sure that we don't get. members to market.